Good morning, Golden Hawks. Welcome to Weather Aware, presented by The Morning Show, Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. I'm your host, the one and only Liam McGuckin. It's a cold one out there this morning, folks, but it is also a fairly bright one outside, for now, at least. You know, you can see some pockets of blue sky peeking through the clouds, but it won't last long, as you can see the ominous wall of darker clouds moving in from the distance. Regardless, though, I'm glad you're choosing to spend the rest of your morning, sunny or cloudy, with me. And this is just my opinion, me personally saying this, but I think you choosing to spend your morning with me will pay off after the first break. I got a very, very important storm watch today, and a lot of you won't like it, but I think it's still a very important one, so stay tuned very shortly for that. I did just quickly want to say, for anyone that doesn't know or is a little confused after last week's show, that was a one-off thing. All right, we are back to regular scheduled programming for the rest of the semester. You know, normal two-hour slots, so unfortunately, you're stuck with me for an extra hour for the next five shows, and then the rest of the shows for next semester. You can call that a daylight savings of sorts. You're getting an extra hour with the show. But without further ado, let's just get right into it with the show forecast. So in the first hour of the show, a storm watch gets issued for this weekend, where a certain S-word makes its grand return. And I'm pretty sure it's the same S-word everyone's thinking right now. We'll find out later. I'll also be discussing Hurricane Melissa, a devastating yet impressive display of weather. In the second hour of the show, it's not nearly as news-related as I attempt to answer the question everybody asked in unison this weekend. Why do we still do daylight savings? It's a good question. It's a really good question. There's a lot of interesting history and complications and stuff like that I'll be discussing. I think it's a very interesting segment. So also make sure to stay tuned at the top of the second hour for that. I'll also be discussing the newest episode of In the Eye of the Storm before delivering the weekly forecast. How'd I say format? My trademark guaranteed three-day forecast and your Laurier exclusive news report. As for the recap, I gotta admit, there's not much to discuss weather-wise with the recap. You know, more or less, it's just kind of last week's reheated nachos. You know, it was cloudy. It was cold. It was actually colder this week than last week. And as always with this weird transition period in November, it was also depressing. Cold, cloudy, and depressing. And I will also note, though, it was wet. It was very wet. We got a lot of rain in the last week or so. We even got some rain yesterday. We got some rain Monday. It's a lot of rain. I remember walking to class yesterday. It was super gloomy, super dark, super wet. It's definitely interesting to see for November. Usually, you don't get this much rain, as much as I see, at least in November. So, I appreciated it. I like the rain. I don't know if you like the rain, but I appreciated it, at least. I cannot speak for the weekend in Waterloo, but in Mississauga, yes, I was once again in Mississauga for the weekend. It was warmer, but still cold. I'll say Saturday was a beautiful day, or at least it turned into a beautiful day. It was a really, really gloomy day. I saw all these dark clouds coming in, but by the evening, it turned out to be a very beautiful sunny day. It was still a little cold, but it got warmer. Sky looked pretty on Saturday night. Everything was going well because it was game 7 for the Blue Jays. But unfortunately, what I can't say is beautiful about Saturday was, of course, it's the real talk of the town, the Blue Jays loss. Yeah. You know, the thing that frustrates me the most is ironically, I think the fact that you can't really be mad about the game. You know, the Jays played fantastic and went into overtime. Lots of iconic moments. It was, all in all, a really strong end to a fantastic World Series. I'm upset about the loss. Don't get me wrong. I think everyone is upset about the loss, but I don't think anyone can really be angry about the loss. I will note, I did have the absolute pleasure of being down at the Bird's Nest once again in Toronto at Nathan Phillips Square. Only this time, instead of a crowd of maybe 800 people, it was a crowd of 5,000 people. I got to watch the game with Mayor Olivia Chow. Yeah, there's a photo of me watching the game with her very intensely. We're both very intensely watching that game. I also got a beef patty from Mayor Olivia Chow. She randomly just came and gave everyone beef patties. And I know this sounds like a fake story. I understand how crazy this sounds. But it is a real thing that happened. Trust me, I was there. It was awesome. But this, of course, also means that I was there for all of the big moments with crowd reaction, including the moment everyone in Canada collectively sighed in disappointment because, unfortunately, Because, unfortunately, the Jays are a Toronto sports team after all, and they lost. And I caught it on video. So here is that moment when the Jays unfortunately lost. Devastating stuff, I know. And I think that'll be a lot of you after the storm watch, at least in Waterloo. But it's just unfortunate. I think it's cool I got it on video, but it's just unfortunate. Another big event that happened within the last week or so was Halloween. As everyone knows, I had an awesome Halloween power hour last week, but I can now talk about Halloween itself. You know, I had a very fun time at a Halloween party with a few friends. You know, we ended up watching episode one of that new It show, you know, Welcome to Derry with Pennywise the Clown, which I can only describe as having probably the most unexpected ending I could think of. Trust me, if you watch that show, I think you'll start to figure out what the ending will be, but you'll also be going like, no, they wouldn't do that. Yes, they would. It is very shocking. I also saw a lot of cool costumes on King Street, and the party was still going at around 2 in the morning, which, you know, I love to see. I love to see the vibe, the party vibe at Laurier happening so late, carrying on through the night. That's exactly what Halloween should be about. And speaking of Halloween and horror, I did get around to watching The Long Walk. As I said last week, I would talk about it briefly, and here it is. I can 100% recommend it. I definitely think it's not really as horror as much as it is kind of like a sci-fi, psychological kind of horror. It's a lot like Squid Games with the violence where it's a long walk until one man's left standing. Anyone who fails on the way gets shot, that kind of thing. It's a fantastic movie, but I think if you're looking for like a more proper horror movie, I'd say Weapons might be it for you. At least from the horror movies I've seen. I'll see more soon, but that's at least how much I've seen. I did love it either way, though. I can definitely recommend it. Coming back to the weather quickly, you know, there was a cool thunderstorm at the end of The Long Walk, which I did also hear that during the rain on Monday, the GTA might have received some thunderstorms. I saw a lot of drama come out on the weather community because two meteorologists started fighting. You see, one of them saw a possible tornado on the radar around the York region, but the other one said, you know, don't scare people. The chance is essentially non-existent. I've never seen meteorologists fight before, honestly. I mean, personally, I say the goal should be to keep people safe and weather aware. And if a supercell was observed on the weather radar, I don't know. I think that's worth mentioning, personally, at least. There's not really much to say about the forecast accuracy other than, you know, as usual, it was pretty accurate. So we're just going to move straight into the short break. And with that, we're going to go on a short break now. It's currently 10:11, 4 degrees and cloudy in Waterloo, Ontario. It's getting cold in the mornings, and it's only going to get colder. You can really start to feel winter seeping in. So I'm going to play us into the break with a song that has a wintry vibe. To me, at least. I think it does. While not remotely being about winter in the slightest. As far as I'm aware, you know? I'm going to play us into the break with The Divine Chord by The Avalanches, MGMT, and Johnny Marr on Radio Laurier. You know what that sound means, folks. Welcome to Stormwatch, your go-to source to stay ahead of the storm. Today, I'll be going in-depth about an upcoming storm with a chilling twist. As some of you might have been hearing in the last couple days, there's been murmurs of a snowstorm arriving this weekend, and to many people's disarray, at least were it being this early, I am here to confirm these rumors. The first snowfall of the season arrived before we could even make it to Remembrance Day. Wow. That is just insane to me, man. Never, ever thought the first snowfall of the season could possibly be this early on. So, as I'm probably a lot of you are asking right now, why on earth is this happening this early? Well, let's break it down. You see, in the atmosphere, you got a little something called a jet stream. It's a fast-flowing, narrow band of air that moves from the west to the east. Think of it as what it is, a giant squiggly line with a very strong wind current, bringing air with different temperatures with it, right? The higher the bumps in the squiggly line, the more extreme the temperature differences are. South of the jet stream, you got warmer air, and north of the jet stream, you got colder air. Now, the environment is setting up a perfect scenario for an early snowstorm. You got a steep trough in the jet stream developing late Saturday, moving into Sunday, which is bringing Arctic air with it. You also have a low-pressure system moving in from the States, bringing with it naturally an even more prime environment for a storm. You see, with low-pressure systems, the air is forced to rise, and once it rises, it cools and then sinks. But if it sinks, where's all that moisture from the low-pressure system going? Well, it condenses. It condenses and forms clouds and even precipitation, and that's exactly what this low-pressure system is going to do. The low brings with it a storm. So, the ingredients are in place. You know, you got that steep trough in the jet stream that sets in a short-lived pattern of colder temperatures with the Arctic air coming in, and a low-pressure system arriving at the same time as it gets cold. Temperatures get primed for snow, low-pressure system moves in, and thus the system should be given snow. And I understand. I know it sounds scary, snow this early in November, but I'm here to explain what we currently know about the storm using the four W's. Who, what, when, and where. I'll start off with Waterloo and then move into Mississauga, as always with storm watches. But it is worth noting that as of now, this is primarily a Waterloo system. That'll make sense very soon. But all I'll say right now is Mississauga listeners can ease up a bit for now. So, what's going on for Waterloo? Well, I'm basing this information I'm about to tell you off of the two weather models that I like to use, the GFS model and the ECMWF model. Currently, a storm is poised to hit the region this weekend. overnight Saturday, but mainly early morning Sunday. The system will move through the region. It'll impact us mainly during the morning before tapering on and off throughout the day. More precipitation is expected to arrive briefly on Monday morning before anyone wakes up, though, and then once again tapers on and off in the evening. Mississauga can expect much of the same, pretty much. A storm is poised to hit the region this weekend as well. It'll mostly be impactful on Sunday morning before weakening a bit in the afternoon, completely tapering off come evening. This is the stuff that we know. But it gets a little tricky, right? So here's where it gets a little tricky. Remember the past couple forecasts, I've been pointing out a very weird little pattern, how Mississauga has been warmer than Waterloo? Remember that little pattern? Well, for any Mississauga listeners, this is what potentially saves you guys from snow. You see, temperatures are expected to hover around the freezing mark on Sunday in Mississauga, but never at the freezing mark. Without the wind chill, you're still looking at 2-3 degree lows and even reaching close to 5 degrees sometimes throughout the day. Now, I want you to compare that with Waterloo, reaching a temperature of -2 and 0 throughout the day with even colder wind chills. The air is more than cold enough here for snow to form, but in Mississauga, it gets a little more complicated because of the fact it's sitting at temperatures of, 2, 3, and even 4 degrees mostly, which is cold, don't get me wrong, but it's not exactly cold enough for snow. Both of the models agree that the GTA, which, specifically areas close to Lake Ontario, will see mostly nothing, really. There's a chance that you guys could receive, trace amounts getting more inland of, trace amounts of snow. But generally, it's looking like most areas near Lake Ontario aren't going to see any snow, but rather it's just going to be a rain system. The ECMWF model does say there's a chance the GTA mostly sees possibly trace amounts of snow. Moving more inland into southwestern Ontario is where temps start dipping and snow starts falling. The GFS model currently shows Waterloo receiving a total of roughly 10 to 12 centimeters of snow, whereas the ECMWF model shows Waterloo getting closer to 5 to 7 centimeters of snow. The models are only starting to agree on tracks right now, but the big problem is that they can't decide on where the cutoff begins. That cutoff being the transition from rain to snow. ECMWF has the cutoff very, very close to our region, so naturally we will receive less snow, but it also pictures the storm as a much more intense system for areas like Cottage Country, more like Goderich, more areas closer west. The further north and further west you go in southern Ontario, the more snow you're going to get, pretty much, if that makes any sense. The GFS model, on the other hand, has the storm more spread out, which is good for snow lovers in Waterloo, but it could also mean it needs more refinements. If it's more spread out, it could mean that with how defined the storm is on the ECMWF model, GFS model might need a little bit more refinement. But I can't say, honestly, because the system as a whole is pretty messy. And because of how messy the system is, and with further agreement really needed for a track, here's what I'm going to do. Because this is all that we know right now. I'm going to make a follow-up video on Saturday, where I give the final say about this storm. The one thing the models are agreeing on right now, though, is that Waterloo sees anywhere between 5 to 10 centimeters of snow this weekend. So bundle up, because it'll be a cold one. But once again, we are still a little far out from the storm, so definitely stay tuned on the Instagram. That is at WeatherAwareLiam, because I will be making a follow-up update video on Saturday to properly tell you guys everything you need to know about the storm, because by Saturday, it's got to be finalized. That's a day before the storm. Usually with winter storms, it's finalized, a day before, sometimes 2 days before. But the fact that models are only now agreeing on tracks tells me it'll probably be ready late tomorrow, early Saturday morning. So I'll probably be dropping a video early afternoon, maybe mid-afternoon. We'll have to see. We're going to go on a short break now. It's currently 10:23, 4 degrees, with a sharp wind chill of 1 degree, and something very weird has happened. All the clouds have dispersed. I'm looking out my window right now. It is blue skies as far as the eye can see. Don't know where that came from, but I am glad to see it. So right now it is sunny, 4 degrees, feels like 1, in Waterloo, Ontario. It might not seem like it now, but by Sunday, winter will be saying, finally, someone let me out of my cage. Gonna play us into the break with Clint Eastwood by the Gorillaz on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. Finally got my opportunity to play Clint Eastwood. I told you on the first show I was going to play it now that the censorship laws have changed, and I finally did it. One of my favorite songs, at least from the Gorillaz. I love that song. Dare is another great one, as well as On Melancholy Hill. Love those ones. Anywho, as I'm sure many of you have heard, it has been the talk of the town for the last week or so, other than the Blue Jays' loss, unfortunately. A devastating hurricane hit Jamaica, amongst other regions in the tropics, last week. Now that the hurricane has dissipated completely and we are back on regular scheduled programming, it's time to tell the tale of Hurricane Melissa. An impressive display of weather, but maybe too impressive? I'll let you form your own thoughts at the end. But before all of that, let's establish the who, what, when, where, and how of Melissa with a meteorological synopsis. Melissa's story, weirdly enough, starts all the way back in Reading Week. On October 16, 2025, the National Hurricane Center began monitoring a westward-moving tropical wave for potential development. On October 19th, the wave moved through the Windward Islands and into the Caribbean Sea. This disturbance moved quickly westward, then slowed significantly, providing an opportunity for development of a well-defined center. And on October 21st, the wave would officially intensify and transform into a tropical storm named Melissa. On account of weak steering currents, Melissa moved slowly and erratically west to northwest over the very warm waters of the Central Caribbean, unable to strengthen appreciably due to westerly wind shear. And by the way, wind shear is a sudden change in wind speed or direction over a short distance. I'm guessing with the westerly wind shear, that probably means that the hurricane was moving in the opposite direction of the wind, so they were kind of clashing, which made it unable to strengthen appreciably. On October 23rd, the wind shear began to weaken, enabling convection, which is a cycle where warm air rises, turns to cool air, and begins to sink. It can cause more stormy weather. Kind of like the low-pressure system I mentioned in the storm watch. So yeah, convection was a thing which led it to begin developing in the direction of the shear from the storm center. As a result, Melissa became better aligned vertically, turning more northward and strengthened the following day. Melissa would rapidly intensify following favorable conditions on October 25th with sustained winds of up to 225 kilometers an hour, which is a huge improvement over the 115 kilometers an hour it sustained only 18 hours prior. That is rapid intensification right there. And with this, and some even further intensification, it would officially be deemed a Category 5 hurricane. It was able to sustain the status for a long period of time, even at landfall,
because it never actually underwent a process called eyewall replacement cycle. Which, I know, very fancy terminology, sounds scary. I'll break it down for you. If you ever looked at a hurricane on radar imagery, you'd notice it has a very clear circle or a very clear hole in the middle, right? This is the eye of the storm, officially and scientifically known as a hurricane's eyewall. You see, usually when hurricanes intensify, especially given certain conditions, an outer ring of thunderstorms can form around this eyewall. This ring of thunderstorms will then proceed to constrict this eyewall, pushing further and further inland before it finally collapses because it's derived of moisture and momentum. I think the best way to explain an eyewall replacement cycle, it's pretty much the weather version of a boa constrictor choking out its victims. The thunderstorms being the boa constrictor chokes out the eyewall, loses moisture, loses momentum, it dies. Then this ring of thunderstorms then assumes the position of the new eyewall. It briefly closes the original eyewall before opening up again as a brand new eyewall. And that's the replacement cycle. This cycle usually ends up increasing the size of hurricanes, but it also usually ends up causing brief temporary weakening of a storm. You see, Melissa never went through this process. Usually, again, because of the temporary weakening, hurricanes can get to Category 5 status, but quickly, because of this eyewall process, replacement cycle, they lose that status, and they have to build up to Category 5 again. Melissa never had to build up again. It was always a Category 5 hurricane for a while because it never went through that temporary de-intensification. So as the storm approached Jamaica, thankfully, Jamaica had a plan. The Ministry of Transportation of Jamaica deployed 30 buses for the emergency situation in Portmore, Spanish Town, Rockfort, and Montego Bay. The National Water Commission mobilized teams and equipment. The University of the West Indies ordered the evacuations of its students in Mona, and graduation ceremonies at the Mona campus were postponed. The National Water Commission gave access to clean drinking water to over 548,000 people in preparation for the arrival of Melissa. On October 24th, public institutions, including the National Gallery of Jamaica and the Bob Marley Museum, were closed. And finally, on October 25th, all airports got shut down. Services and transportation associated with the Jamaica Urban Transit Company were suspended. Surrounding areas took notes as well, with Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Cuba, amongst other places, taking the necessary precautions as well. With a Category 5 strength and a strong environment in favor of the hurricane with those warm waters, Melissa would make landfall near New Hope in the Westmoreland Parish at its peak intensity. Category 5. This is where our story starts. By October 27th, prior to Melissa's landfall in Jamaica, three people in St. Elizabeth, St. Catherine, and Hanover parishes died of indirect causes, and 13 others were injured while preparing for the hurricane. Flooding was reported in Old Harbor, while multiple communities in St. Elizabeth Parish had lost power by 6 o'clock local time. By 10 a.m. our time, about 200,000 customers, or 35% of Jamaica's homes and businesses, were all left without power. Around 52,000 Jamaica public service customers lost power as Melissa approached the island. This number would rise to over 500,000 people after Melissa struck the island. The parishes of St. Elizabeth, Westmoreland, St. James, Trelawney, and Hanover, which received the worst of Melissa's impacts, lost all communication. Melissa would make landfall in New Hope, Westmoreland, as an extremely powerful Category 5 hurricane. I saw some people online arguing it should be a Category 6 for some reason. I don't think that's true. It was just a very powerful Category 5. But I did see some people saying, oh, it should be Category 6. Which gives a good idea on how powerful it was. Extensive damage was reported in St. Elizabeth, with the parish described as being underwater. That's how bad this stuff was. Communities in the parish were reportedly obliterated, with entire buildings collapsing. Severe flooding was reported in several locations, including Manville, where houses were submerged up to their roofs in water. A BBC journalist described the town as being, quote, flattened by the hurricane. It was estimated that nearly 90% of the town's homes lost their roofs. Much of Montego Bay was also flooded, including the city's port, industrial park, and Sangster International Airport's terminal, with much of the ceiling having collapsed. Building collapses, roof damage, and downed trees were also reported in Falmouth, which was described as, quote, all but destroyed. In Kingston, a billboard frame was partially toppled and was flooded, while a landslide blocked a road in Gordontown. In Jamaica, at least 32 people were killed and 96 others were injured. As for the other major areas that saw destruction, Haiti saw a lot of tragedy. 43 people were killed and 13 declared missing. At least 450 homes were damaged. In the Dominican, more than 1.1 million were without water supply after heavy rainfall and flooding disrupted water supply systems, including in Pedro Brand, Los Alcarrizos, and Santo Domingo Oeste. Prior to Melissa's landfall in Cuba, the hurricane caused flooding and landslides in the southeastern province of Santiago de Cuba. Melissa made landfall east of Chivirico in Santiago de Cuba at around 7:10 local time on October 29th, with sustained winds of 195 kilometers per hour. President Miguel Diaz-Canel reported considerable damage from the hurricane in Cuba, with widespread flooding and streets buried in debris across Santiago de Cuba. Around 992,000 houses, almost a million, were damaged or destroyed in Guantanamo, Holguín, and the Santiago de Cuba provinces. 17 people were injured and 3 million others were affected across the country, with 735,000 in shelters. Two people died due to the Sagua River overflowing. The Cauto River overflowed as well, with some regions receiving around 20 inches of rainfall, which is roughly 508 millimeters of rain. That is a lot of rain, man. Holy. In the aftermath of the storm, the Miami Heat basketball team and its regional partners donated around $1 million in supplies and necessary items as part of recovery efforts in Jamaica following Melissa. Various South Florida aid organizations also mobilized to provide assistance to affected island states. Disney would also donate $1 million for relief efforts. The World Bank activated a support package alongside the Jamaican government and the Inter-American Development Bank to conduct a post-storm damage analysis. The government of the Cayman Islands sent $200,000 worth of supplies and pledged $1.2 million in aid to Jamaica. Bermudair organized an airlift for Jamaica. The government of Trinidad and Tobago sent 8 containers of supplies to Jamaica and pledged to send even more aid in the coming days. Home Depot co-founder Arthur Blank announced that he would donate $1.5 million to the World Central Kitchen to help provide food and water for those affected. So, a lot of donations. That's how I can sum this up. A lot of donations happened to help out Jamaica and the surrounding areas with relief efforts. Before I went on break, I did just want to point out how many records that Melissa ties and breaks. Because it is truly insane how many it breaks for one single storm, or even ties for one single storm. First off, globally, it is the strongest tropical cyclone of 2025 by far, at least to date. But it is November 6th, it is the end of hurricane season. So I think we can get rid of that due date. We always get one, you know, we always get one very strong hurricane. We got two last year, granted. But we always get one that is always talked about in the news, and Melissa ended up being that one. And it is even known as the strongest tropical hurricane. Globally, it also has the highest wind gust ever measured, which is 406 kilometers per hour. Released by NOAA, NOAA Hurricane Hunters at an altitude of 200 meters. This is subject to reanalysis, but as of now, it is the highest wind gust ever measured by their hurricane hunters. It's tied with the 1935 Labor Day hurricane as the third most intense Atlantic hurricane on record, intense in terms of lowest barometric pressure, behind Hurricanes Wilma and Gilbert. And tied with Hurricanes Wilma, Gilbert, Dorian, and the 1935 Labor Day hurricane as the second most intense Atlantic hurricane in terms of 1 minute sustained wind speeds, behind Hurricane Allen. I know, these are all such threatening names. I'm so terrified of Hurricane Allen. Don't know why they don't give these things more threatening names. I've always been confused about that. I don't think anyone's going to be scared by Hurricane Allen or Wilma, Hurricane Gilbert, Hurricane Dorian, Melissa. They're all weird names. And it is also tied with the 1935 Labor Day hurricane as well for most intense Atlantic hurricanes at landfall in terms of lowest barometric pressure. And with the 1935 Labor Day hurricane and Hurricane Dorian for the strongest landfalling hurricane in the Atlantic in terms of maximum sustained wind speeds. It's also the strongest tropical cyclone to make landfall in Jamaica on record. Wow. That was a lot of records. When I read all that, I was shocked. Maybe it should be a Category 6 hurricane. I'm just joking. I don't think it'll be a while till we see a new category get introduced. Maybe someone should send in some fan mail about the categories of hurricane, and I can then explain the categories of hurricane. Who knows? We'll see what happens. We'll see if I get sent anything in the next week or so. We'll have to see. But yeah, that was Hurricane Melissa. It's a tale of destruction, but also a tale of very impressive weather feats, as you just heard. Personally, I think it might be a little too impressive. There was no reason for a hurricane this strong to be impacting Jamaica. It also just seems rude because of how late in hurricane season is. It is like they thought they were done with hurricane season, and then all of a sudden, at the very, very last moment, the strongest hurricane of the season comes in. Just seems like one last massive F you, you know what I mean? We're going to go on another short break now. It is currently 10:46. 4 degrees, feels like one, and I can see those clouds coming back. I'm starting to see them peeking through the window, but I'm also seeing that blue sky staying there, so we'll have to see which way the clouds go by the end of the show. I've never seen such a cloudy day turn into a day with blue skies. I'm expecting it to go back to cloudy soon, but if you're out right now listening in Waterloo, definitely enjoy the sunny skies. I'm going to play us into the break with a song that, after that story, I just feel fits the vibe well. I don't know why. I can't describe why. You know, maybe it's the tone. Maybe it's the instrumental. I don't know. But I think it just does. Maybe it's the tone. Form your own opinions about it. With how strong their tourism industry is, though, I will say this. As much as it looks like one, it's hardly a sink or swim when all is well and the ticket sells. Congratulations by MGMT on Radio Laurier.
Welcome back from the break. And welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. Humanity has famously always been at arms with each other. You know, no one can agree on anything. But 2 times a year, in unison, everybody asks the exact same question on the exact same days. Why do we even do daylight savings? 2 times a year, we all turn the clocks back and forth an hour, consistently forgetting about it until maybe 5 hours before you're supposed to do daylight savings. And you go, oh yeah, we turn the clocks back an hour tonight. Or, oh yeah, we turn the clocks forward an hour tonight. Well, maybe it's a rhetorical question. I don't know. But there is an answer as to why we do daylight savings still, with some very interesting history to go alongside it. On today's Weather Aware episode, we dare to go places most meteorologists have probably gone before, but some have not. We dare to ask the question and answer it, why do we even do daylight savings? I figured a good spot to start was the history behind it. And looking into it, it has a lot of very interesting history. How far back does the idea of changing the time go? Well, it goes all the way back to ancient civilizations. Ancient civilizations adjusted daily schedules to the sun more flexibly than daylight saving times does. And I'll probably sometimes refer to daylight savings time as DST, just to shorten it up. So if I ever say DST in the next 10, 15 minutes or so, just know that's what it is, daylight savings time. So yeah, ancient civilizations would adjust daily schedules to the sun more flexibly than DST does, you know, often dividing daylight into 12 hours regardless of daytime, so that each daylight hour became progressively longer during spring and shorter during autumn. For example, the Romans kept time with water clocks that had different scales for different months of the year. At Rome's latitude, the third hour from sunrise started at 9:02 solar time and lasted 44 minutes at the winter solstice. But at the summer solstice, it started at 6:58 and lasted 75 minutes, which is a lot more than the 44 minutes in the winter solstice. From the 14th century onward, equal-length civil hours supplanted unequal ones, so civil time no longer varied by the season. Despite a weird belief looking into this that Benjamin Franklin, of all people, invented the idea of daylight savings by publishing the proverb, "Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise." Of course he'd say that. It wouldn't be until 1895 that DST would first be proposed. Enter New Zealand entomologist George Hudson. In 1895, he presented a paper to the Wellington Philosophical Society proposing a 2-hour daylight saving shift, and considerable interest was expressed in Christchurch. He followed up with an 1898 paper. Many publications credit the DST proposal to prominent English builder and outdoorsman William Willett. Gotta love that name, William Willett. Sounds like a cartoon character or something. So yeah, William Willett, he is credited to the DST proposal. And William Willett, who independently conceived DST in 1907 during a pre-breakfast ride when he observed how many Londoners slept through a large part of a summer day. Willett also was an avid golfer who disliked cutting short his round at dusk. His solution was to advance the clock during the summer, and he published the proposal 2 years later. Liberal Party Member of Parliament Robert Pierce took up the proposal, introducing the first daylight saving bill to the British House Commons on the 12th of February, 1908. A select committee was set up to examine the issue, but Pierce's bill did not become law, and several other bills failed in the following years. Willett lobbied for the proposal in the UK until his death in 1915.
So he's the first guy to propose the idea, but that's just the idea. Where was it first implemented? Well, where else but here? I mean, where else would have such a odd concept than Ontario? Yes, Port Arthur, Ontario, Canada, was the first city in the world to enact DST, because of course it's Ontario. Why wouldn't we do that? And this was on July 1st, 1908. This was soon followed by a second Ontario town, Orilla, which was introduced by William Swordfrost, another insane name, and he was mayor. William Swordfrost was mayor from 1911 to 1912 in Orillia, Ontario. The first states to adopt DST nationally were those of the German Empire and its World War I ally, Austria-Hungary, commencing on April 30th, 1916, as a way to conserve coal during wartime. Britain, most of its allies, and many European neutrals soon followed. Russia and a few other countries waited until the next year, and the U.S. adopted daylight savings in 1918. Most jurisdictions abandoned DST in the years after the war ended in 1918, with exceptions including Canada, the U.K., France, Ireland, and the United States. It's a common myth in the U.S. that DST was first implemented for the benefit of farmers. As I'm sure many people have heard, in reality, farmers have been one of the strongest lobbying groups against DST since it was first implemented. The factors that influence farming schedules, such as morning dew and dairy cattle's readiness to be milked, are ultimately dictated by the sun, so the clock change introduces unnecessary challenges. DST was actually first implemented in the U.S. with the Standard Time Act in 1918, a wartime measure for 7 months during World War I, in the interest of adding more daylight hours to conserve energy resources. Year-round daylight savings time, or wartime, was implemented again during World War II. After the war, local jurisdictions were free to choose if and when to observe DST until the Uniform Time Act, which standardized daylight saving time in 1966. Permanent daylight saving time was signed into law by President Richard Nixon in January of 1974. But there were complaints of children going to school in the dark and working people commuting and starting their workday in pitch darkness during the winter. And by October 1974, President Gerald Ford signed a law repealing year-round daylight savings time. The very concept of daylight savings has actually caused a lot more controversy than simple online rants about why it sucks the sun sets at 5 p.m. now, believe it or not. And it goes a long way back, all the way back to Winston Churchill. Yes, Winston Churchill argued that it enlarges, quote, the opportunities for the pursuit of health and happiness among the millions of people who live in this country. And pundits have dubbed it daylight slaving time. Retailing, sports, and tourism interests have historically favored daylight savings, while agricultural and evening entertainment interests, and even some religious groups, have opposed it. Energy crisis and war prompted its initial adoption. Since Germany's adoption of daylight saving time in 1916, the world has seen many enactments, adjustments, and repeals of DST with similar politics involved. The history of time in the U.S. features DST during both world wars, but no standardization of peacetime DST until 1966. St. Paul in Minneapolis, Minnesota, kept different clocks for 2 weeks in May 1965. The capital city decided to switch to daylight saving time, while Minneapolis opted to follow the later date set by state law. In the mid-1980s, Clorox and 7-Eleven provided the primary funding for the Daylight Saving Time Coalition behind the 1987 extension to U.S. Daylight Savings Time. Both senators from Idaho, Larry Craig and Mike Crapo, voted for it based on the premise, and this is a real thing, those two senators voted for the extension based on the premise that fast food restaurants would sell more French fries made from Idaho potatoes during DSD. That's funny. A referendum on the introduction of daylight saving took place in Queensland, Australia in 1992 after a three-year trial of daylight savings. It was defeated with a 54.5% no vote, with regional and rural areas strongly opposed and those in the metropolitan southeast in favor. Russia declared in 2011 that it would stay in DSD all year long, and Belarus followed with a similar declaration. The Soviet Union had operated under permanent, quote-unquote, summertime from 1930 to at least 1982. Summertime being when we... It's getting dark. Summertime being when we spring forward the clocks. I think it's lose an hour? I think we lose an hour during the summer. It gets, when you think about it too much, daylight savings can get a little complicated, but it's when we spring forward the clocks. That's what I'm getting at. Russia's plan generated widespread complaints due to the dark of wintertime mornings, and thus, it was abandoned in 2014. The country changed its clocks to standard time on October 26, 2014, intending to stay there permanently. In the United States, Arizona, with the exception of the Navajo Nation, Hawaii, and the five populated territories, American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Northern Mariana Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, do not participate in daylight savings time. Indiana only began participating in daylight saving time as recently as 2006. And between 2018 and 2024, former Florida Senator Marco Rubio repeatedly filed bills to extend daylight saving time permanently into the winter without success. Funnily enough, the U.S. keeps attempting to abolish DST with a quote-unquote Sunshine Protection Act, but it consistently keeps getting struck down in Congress. The European Union voted in 2019 to abolish it, but they haven't yet agreed on which time to keep, making things even messier. And even putting politics and controversy aside, by the way, which are all subjective things, did you know that daylight savings objectively might even be straight up harmful for you? Let's learn all about that. Yeah, I bet none of you actually heard that it could be harmful for you. Gonna show you my psychology brain right now. I get to finally use psychology information that I learned all the way back in semester one. Because it has been shown to disrupt human circadian rhythms. Circadian rhythms are essentially how our bodies relate to day-night cycles. It's relating to sleep. We're used to, our bodies pretty much go based off a sun and moon cycle. And because of the fact that, at least with the wintertime, we're going back an hour, nighttime becomes a lot longer, you get less daylight, it screws up circadian rhythms pretty much. So because it's been, it has been shown to disrupt human circadian rhythms, negatively affecting human health in the process, and that the yearly DSD clock shifts can increase health risks, like heart attacks and traffic accidents. I know, it sounds insane. I know you're probably going, what are you talking about? No way, a clock change can cause heart attacks and traffic accidents. It can. Let's get into it. A 2017 study in the American Economic Journal estimated that the transition into DST caused over 30 deaths at a social cost of $275 million annually, primarily by increasing sleep deprivation. A correlation between clock shifts and increase in traffic collisions has been observed in North America and the UK, but not in Finland or Sweden. Four reports have found that this effect is smaller than the overall reduction in traffic fatalities. According to data shared by Titan Casket, hospitals see a 24% increase in heart attacks and a 6% increase in fatal crashes. Each year when the time changes, In 2018, the European Parliament, reviewing a possible abolition of DST, approved a more in-depth evaluation examining the disruption of the human body's circadian rhythms, which provided evidence suggesting the existence of an association between the DST clock shifts and a modest increase of occurrence of acute myocardial infarction. Which, I know, sounds scary, sounds, oh, what is that? Well, it's just the science-y mumbo-jumbo version of a heart attack. I think that's the best way to describe it. They were found especially increased in the first week after the spring shift, surprisingly, when you spring forward an hour. So, yeah, when you lose an hour of sleep. That makes sense. There we go. Finally got the answer. Spring shift is when you lose an hour of sleep because you're springing forward an hour. However, a Netherlands study found, against the majority of investigations, contrary or minimal effect. Year-round standard time, not year-round DST. There's a difference there. It's proposed by some to be the preferred option for public health and safety. Clock shifts were found to increase the risk of heart attack by 10% and to disrupt sleep and reduce its efficiency. Effects on seasonal adaptation of the circadian rhythm can be severe and last for weeks. So, let's just recap a little bit here, right? A solid chunk of the world doesn't really use it anymore. It's found to be straight up harmful for you. And it causes a lot of debate and controversy. Its original purpose to save energy doesn't really even apply to the modern society anymore because we're always using up energy. So it's essentially pointless. It's time to actually ask the question, why on earth we still use DST? Well, the answer is a little more complicated than it may sound, but the answer lies in the fact that humanity can't really agree on much. I'll get into that last, but first, how about the one single genuine benefit DST provides, and possibly the one reason why it's kept? Of course, that being money. Who would have guessed? Of course it's money. Retail industries, amongst other things, like, you know, entertainment, really benefit from it. The extra daylight means more shopping and, more importantly, extra money. People are more awake, people are shopping longer, people are buying longer. You get more money. But that's not really the answer, though. The funny thing is, this is the real answer here, maybe it's not one you like, but the funny thing is that everybody hates DST, hates daylight savings time, and wants to abolish it. I don't know a single person that wants to keep it. But no one can agree on what time to keep. That is the answer. This is a system, daylight savings time, that has been in place for centuries now, right? It's not something that just goes away overnight. And we've seen that. Most of the world has gotten rid of it based on decades and decades of political choices and tensions. The places that still have it want to get rid of it. But we keep it because no one knows what time they want to keep. So, to please everybody, they just keep both times. Some people like longer nights, like myself. I know, a lot of people don't like it. I like it. And some people like longer days. But the one thing everybody dislikes is having to actually stand up at 1 o'clock, make sure, oh yeah, I gotta change the clocks, gotta manually change the alarm clocks, that kind of stuff. All clocks that aren't phones, you gotta go and manually change it. And then if you forget about it the next morning, you're gonna wake up and go, oh my god, it's the wrong time. You're gonna wake up in a panic and like, oh yeah, daylight savings just causes a lot of issues. That's my point. Scientists and health organizations do recommend permanent standard time, which is when we fall back an hour. So it's when we have longer nights. It's recommended because the human body goes on a sun-moon cycle, right? And naturally, we get more sleep when there's less daylight. It also encourages people to wake up early, which does have health benefits. I can speak to this as an early riser, or ex-early riser, I guess. I'm telling you, man, a week changed everything. I used to wake up at 6:30, 6 o'clock sometimes. A week, I started waking up after that at around 9 and 10. I have no clue how that happened. No clue what changed. So, yeah. But as an ex-early riser, I can speak to that. It does kind of have health benefits. Personally, I just like the aesthetic of nighttime more, and that's why I prefer the wintertime over summertime. But a lot of people do not like it. Rather, they like sleeping in and, you know, having more daylight to do stuff. It's a really tough debate. And I want to hear your take. Which do you prefer? Springing forward the clock an hour or falling back an hour? Feel free to DM on Instagram at WeatherAwareLiam. That is at WeatherAwareLiam. And one last fun fact for you. Did you know that out of all the provinces and territories in Canada, Saskatchewan is the only province that does not observe DST? Maybe we should take a few notes from Saskatchewan. It was always a pain to, in those drawing, coloring activities in history class, everyone knows what I'm talking about, where you got to color in all the different provinces and territories. Saskatchewan was always a pain because you always had to fit that long name in a tiny slot. But maybe the one thing Saskatchewan does right is not observing DST. So again, it might not have been the answer you guys are looking for. I know it's kind of a crappy answer. You know, we want to get rid of it. No one likes it. But most places just aren't able to agree on a time. Except for Saskatchewan, apparently. Which I love. I really hope in the next 5 years we can, by 2030, let's try to abolish DST so we can keep one time. Maybe one day, hopefully in the next 5 years, we can all agree that falling back is better than springing forward. Gonna go on a short break now. It's currently 11:14. 5 degrees and back to cloudy in Waterloo, Ontario. Every year is getting shorter, and we can never seem to find the time. Why fritter and waste the hours by arguing about which time to keep? Even if there's time to kill today, it just seems like a weird way to kill time. To me, at least. To me. I'm gonna play us into the break with Time, the radio edit by Pink Floyd, on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. Have you ever heard the original version of Time? Right, it's like 5 minutes long. It's all of Pink Floyd's songs are really long. Don't know why. Always been curious about that. All of them have really, really long guitar solos and stuff like that. I remember I was hanging out with my friends one time and the same Pink Floyd song was going on for like 10 minutes. I remember halfway through, I'm like, how is this still playing? The same song. But yeah, great song. Love Time. Amongst my horror recommendations, which I have a lot more now, by the way, excited to get to them at some point, I was also recommended a TV show called In the Eye of the Storm, and I figured it was worth checking out, you know? Seemed at least like good content for the show, and after checking it out, I've come to the conclusion that this recommendation was a gold mine in disguise. 3 seasons worth of content to discuss has been exposed to me, each being an almost hour-long episode with a narrative about a real storm that happened with survivor experiences and found footage, all the sorts. And as an avid enjoyer of crime documentaries, this is right up my alley. And today I'm going to tell you all about it, and hopefully it's up some of your alleys as well. A brand new season recently came out, and I'll be discussing episode 1 of season 3, Tornado Torrent. I know, very cool name, Tornado Torrent. The episode is about a horrific weather outbreak back in March of this year, where over 250 tornadoes were produced, amongst other things. The episode also follows a haboob, which is a nasty, nasty dust storm, and a horrific hailstorm, all produced by the same system, spreading across the states. Some more brief context about the storm. I did some small research after to get some cool statistics for you. This weather outbreak caused 43 deaths, 23 of which were of tornadic nature, over 247 injuries, $11 billion in damages, hail the size of a baseball, wind speeds up to 310 kilometers an hour, over 500,000 power outages, and it affected the Midwest, South, and Eastern areas of the U.S. The outbreak also ended up causing a winter storm near California, with as much as 81 centimeters of snow being reported and recorded. This outbreak lasted just under 4 days, but caused lasting damages for years to come. So, obviously, there's a lot of cover there. They didn't cover the winter storm part, unfortunately. I guess it's still a little too early in the States for that to be aired. But the episode made sure to hit all the bases and more. It splits the narrative up between survivor stories, but also keeps it in chronological order, meaning that survivor stories come and go in the exact same order as it actually happened in real life, to give the viewer the best possible idea of what the storm was like. What I'm saying is it gives the story in real time, which is something I find really, really, really cool. You know, I've seen a weather documentary. Sorry, I've never seen a weather documentary do this. You know, they have survivor stories. They do, obviously. But all the ones I have seen aren't quite like this. In the Eye of the Storm makes it a priority to split up the narrative based on location and timing. Starting out in Texas, you had a storm chaser perspective discussing what he saw with the haboob, which I know, very funny name. But remember, it's just a giant, intense dust storm, pretty much. The documentary goes more in depth about it, but documentaries like these like to show more rather than tell, which is what everyone watches weather documentaries for in the first place. Anyway, let's be honest. No one's really watching documentaries to hear about what happened. They want to see what happened. And this one makes sure to give you found footage with perspectives of who is talking, so you get a good idea. You know, you see stuff like trucks getting toppled over, near zero visibility, all the works. It also gives viewers a very cool opportunity to see a storm chaser's process into how he goes about tracking storms, why he decided it was worth looking into, you know, that kind of stuff. It's nothing too crazy. It was a pretty small segment, but still pretty enjoyable. The thing I was most interested in, obviously, was the actual tornado part of it all. Specifically, the POV of a Fox News meteorologist. See, the thing I liked most about this documentary is that it made sure to explain the weather, right? It gave a professional meteorological synopsis for the terms and the setup of the storm so that viewers fully understood what they were watching unfold. They even had cool things like visual diagrams, captions explaining the terms, all the works. It was really cool to see that kind of meteorological synopsis that I always do in my shows come into play in a professional documentary. And personally, I think more weather documentaries should put in this much effort. You know, I think it's very valuable for viewers to actually understand what's going on. it could end up inspiring a few people as well. Who knows? Anywho, I like the Fox meteorologist's perspective the most because of his story. You see, a tornado outbreak is happening in Florida, and a powerful tornado is making its way towards the Fox News studio down in Florida. He is terrified, not only for himself, but for his family watching at home. But he channels that fear into what I can only describe as locking in. He locked in. He orders everyone at the studio to seek shelter, urges everyone watching nearby to take shelter, all the while being the only one standing up and delivering warnings right in front of the camera, knowing a tornado is coming towards him. I think not only is this a really unique perspective for a documentary, but it's also just such a cool and brave story to tell. That is absolutely something he's always talks about Thanksgiving. You know it. That is a perfect Thanksgiving story. He would also chime in, you know, here and there to explain weather terms, explain the setup of storms, how they form, that kind of stuff. Overall, you know, I think he had one of the cooler perspectives. While that was my favorite, a very, very close second was a team of storm chasers chasing the tornadoes. You know, the documentary, as all documentaries do, has some twists and surprises, as, most documentaries do. But the biggest surprise was panning to a Batmobile. See, this team of storm chasers featured in the documentary ride around, and I can't even describe it, man. It's like some weird bunker weather Batmobile thing. It's armored on the outside, right? It's fitted on the inside with monitors and different ways to track the storms. I have never seen something quite like this. And if I were ever to storm chase, I think it's pretty badass to ride around in a Batmobile. I'll say that. I think it's also very practical to have an armored car because of things like hail. I can't speak for if it's heavy enough not to get lifted off the ground if the tornado's weak enough, but it looks cool. It looks very cool. I'll say that. And even though they're in a Batmobile with very little windows, they somehow still got stunning imagery of the storms. You got to see impressive displays of greens, blacks, yellows, and blues, which can all be seen as a tornado outbreak ravages the states. It also gives yet again a very, very cool look into the behind the scenes of storm chasing. I even recognized a few apps that I like to use in the Batmobile, which is, I thought it was pretty cool. I thought it was very cool. The documentary also takes normal, average resident point of views, which is standard to get that fresh, authentic survivor point of view. No one, someone that doesn't really know a lot about weather. Don't get me wrong. Fantastic. They have people who are knowledgeable about this stuff. But it's also important to have people that are not knowledgeable about the stuff. Just sheer raw emotions and what happened. And there were a lot of them. I'm not going to discuss all of them, but rather I think I am going to discuss the one that stuck out to be the most, which was a horse girl. Yes. There was an odd yet interesting subplot in the documentary about a horse in the documentary named Blondie. In Arkansas, the environment became unstable and prime for supercells to arrive, but before it happened in the documentary, they started building up a weird, not weird, but they started building up a relationship between a horse girl named Tacy and Blondie, the horse. They have a very close bond, like a dog would have to a person, like a pet. When the tornado hit Arkansas and her little stable, a huge metal piece had fallen down onto Blondie. And when they found Blondie, she was limp with no pulse, and they assumed she was dead. And that's what the documentary let you think as well. You know, you had everyone crying in the documentary. The sad music starts playing. You're like, oh, no, the horse died. Oh, no. But at the very end, out of nowhere, this horse plot comes back. Tacy comes back. She's talking about, oh, yeah, you know, I used to like the storms a lot, but the tornado really spooked me. I don't like storms no more. My horses are terrified of storms as well. And then all of a sudden, they just pan the blondie standing up, right? So, yeah, magically, they reveal that out of nowhere, once they removed the metal piece off of Blondie, the horse suddenly jolted back to life and just got up like nothing happened. Which, now that I think about it, sounds exactly like something my older dog Bowie would do. You know, just get up like nothing happened after a huge storm. Absolutely something Bowie would do. And they never elaborate on it. They never explain why the horse didn't die. Like, a giant metal thing fell on it. The interviewees were all puzzled by it as well. And it's not like Blondie has some injury or she's disabled or anything like that. Apparently, Blondie's thriving now. She is doing even better than she was doing before the storm happened. So, you know, it's things like these that make me think the paranormal has something to do with weather. Especially having something to do with a horse magically just jolting back to life. Who's to say? There's a very, very interesting subplot going on there. All in all, In the Eye of the Storm is a very, very interesting documentary, and seemingly it's a very new one too. It only started last year in 2024. It blends weather geek with the average Joe, offering, you know, a very fresh perspective on weather events in a chronological order. Personally, I can recommend it. I think it's definitely worth checking out if you're into found footage and survivor story documentaries, but especially watch it if you're into storm footage. It also doesn't only just cover tornadoes. It seemingly covers, you know, hurricanes, derechos, and just intense storms in general. I'll definitely be returning to the show, you know, every now and then for the radio show, especially for the more interesting episodes. It is currently 11:31, 5 degrees with the wind chill of 2. It feels like 2. And as I predicted, the clouds have rolled back. It got even darker than it was this morning. I don't see any signs of blue sky, so I guess it was nice while the blue sky lasted for maybe half an hour, but we are back to cloudy weather now in Waterloo, Ontario. We are going to move straight into the forecast. As I always say with the weekly forecast, nothing is 100% with the future forecast, hence why I'm only giving a basic overview. Especially for the latter of these days, it is subject to and is likely going to change. Within the next week or so, we observe a massive pattern shift in the weather as it goes from cold, cloudy, and depressing to full-on winter. Because the barometer is diving, northerly winds are blowing, and the flakes will be flying. Sunday, November 9th, you're looking at a high of 1 and a sharp, sharp low of minus 7. And as for the weather on that day, as I mentioned, our aforementioned snowstorm is present in Waterloo, but otherwise mostly cloudy. Monday, November 10th, you're looking at a high of 0, a low of minus 5, and it'll be mostly cloudy with a sliver chance of snow possibly. Tuesday, November 11th, Remembrance Day, you're looking at a high of 2, a low of 0, and yet again, just possibly a small little sliver of snow possible. Just a little sliver. But otherwise, again, it'll be cloudy. Wednesday, November 12th, you're looking at a high of 4, a low of 0, and a chance of mixed precipitation, but otherwise cloudy. And Thursday, November 13th, a week from today, you're looking at a high of 4, a low of minus 2, and cloudy. So, all in all, you're looking at a solid preview of what winter will be like. Stormy and cold. Make sure to bundle up and prepare to walk in the snow to class, as things stand now with the models, forecasting, and stuff like that. Because for if any students listening had an idea that, you know, classes might be canceled because of this, I hate to burst your bubble, but definitely prepare to walk to class in snow if we get any snow, which is looking like we will. Not only is this a system happening on the weekend, but even if it were to happen on a school day, I don't think the amounts we are getting, or we are at least forecasted to get, are enough for school cancellation. So if any of you were thinking, oh, maybe there's a chance school get canceled, unfortunately, no. Sorry to burst your bubbles. But no. Looking more long-term with the forecast, though, I will note, and obviously long-term this year, these are just pattern changes that are coming up, subject to change. But it's looking like after this week of wintry weather, we're going to go back to that more cold, cloudy, depressing transition period that November likes to have, more average temperatures, more average weather. But this winter weather should be coming back in full force come late November, early December. We'll have to see how that works out. Moving into my trademark, Liam's locked in forecast for the weekend. Today you're looking at a high of 7 and a low of 0. We started out with a very, very chilly day to our day. Chilly start to our day. 2 degrees and felt like 0, but at least we did see some sun as it was partly cloudy. And we did see some sun. It was not only partly cloudy, it was clear skies as far as the eye can see for a solid 30 minutes. But moving into the afternoon, you'll see those clouds quickly roll in, but it'll warm up a tiny, tiny bit, being 5 degrees, but feel like 2 with a nasty wind chill in about 20 minutes. Those clouds and temps will stay the same for the rest of the afternoon. Moving into the evening, it'll only get colder with those clouds. And by nightfall today, by 10 p.m., it'll be 1 degrees, but feel like minus 1 with the wind chill. So all in all, a normal November day. Can't complain about that. Tomorrow, Friday, you're looking at a high of 11 and a low of 4. And you're looking at a chance of rain, buddy. You're looking at a much wetter start to your day tomorrow morning as a rain system will make its way through the region. So, hat in the batches. It'll be 5 degrees and feel like 2 with that wind chill at 8 a.m. That rain will continue throughout the morning before slowly tapering off in the afternoon. With that, temperatures also rise a teeny tiny bit as it'll be 8 degrees and feel like 4 with the wind chill. Things warm up substantially moving into the evening with a wind chill of 8, but those clouds do stick around for the day. And by 10 p.m., it'll be 9 degrees, feel like 6, and it'll be cloudy. Those clouds will stick around. On Saturday, you're looking at a high of 6, a low of minus 1, and it'll be cloudy with a, according to my weather app right now, it says there's a teeny tiny risk of snow on Saturday. But I'm guessing that's just at night. We'll get into that very shortly. Because Saturday is the start of that wintry pattern coming into play, right? So the day starts off normal, cloudy and 3 degrees with the wind chill. Those clouds and temps stay the same for the morning and afternoon. And by the evening, you're looking at a small dip in temperatures. Feels like 2 with the wind chill by 5 p.m. But by 10 p.m., those temps are really going to start plummeting as we move into the night and that snowstorm reaches the region. As of now, those temps are really going to start plummeting around 10, 11 p.m. And by 2 a.m., you're looking at that snow arriving around the region because it will be minus 1 and feels like minus 4 with the wind chill. As for a quick overview for my Mississauga listeners, I think this is very good news for anyone thinking it's a little too early for this whole winter weather stuff coming into play. Mississauga kind of gets spared from it. Remember that weird, once again, that weird pattern where Mississauga's warmer than Waterloo? that comes into play yet again. Well, it pays because it pays off very, very nicely for you, as you'll be looking at highs of high single digits and low double digits, but lows ranging between high and low single digits within the next 3 days. Tomorrow seems to be especially warm for November, because you're looking at high of 13 and a low of 3, but it will be raining in the morning. So maybe try to get outside a little bit tomorrow afternoon when the rain tapers down a little bit. I'll say Saturday is looking also pretty good for you. High of 7, a low of 1, and it'll be partly cloudy. So all in all, pretty good. I do want to emphasize Mississauga will still be receiving some form of wintry weather. For example, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, you're looking at lows of minus 5, minus 3, and 2 degrees. But moving after like Wednesday, you're going to return back to those average November temperatures. So it's only a little bit for you guys. Only a little bit of winter weather for you guys. You just got to power through it. You guys just got to power through it. If you don't like winter, you just got to power through it. It'll be fine. You guys will all survive. Moving into the Laurier exclusive news segment, Sexy Bingo returns to Wilfs. Yeah, that's a real thing. If any first years or anyone in Mississauga wants to know and hasn't heard yet, Sexy Bingo is a thing Laurier has. Sexy Bingo is an event where the person asking the questions asks sexy questions, and if you get a bingo, you win sexy prizes. Tonight, from 7:30 to 9:30, head on over to Wilfs and play some sexy bingo. Like I said, sexy questions and sexy prizes. And if anyone doesn't know, the sexy prizes are, in fact, usually sex toys. Unless they've changed it, this is what I was told last year by my Don. The prize is a sex toy if you get a bingo. If you want to do that kind of thing, get your tickets for $3 at the link in bio of Campus Life Waterloo on Instagram. Again, that is at Campus Life Waterloo on Instagram. I'll remind everybody that the talent show is next week at Wilfs, starting at 7 p.m. If you haven't already and want to, sign up at the link in bio of Campus Life Waterloo once again. If you just want to watch, though, there's no tickets, no reservations required, as far as I'm aware. All you got to do is head on over to Wilfs Tuesday night at 7 p.m. On November 12th, from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Turret, head over to there to see Waterloo's first ever Dagwagon Indigenous Art Market. Live music, vendors, all of it will be there. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, definitely head on over to meet the community. Now for sports. Friday night, you got the women's basketball team facing off against the Laurentian team. Laurentian team at the Athletic Complex Gym at 6 p.m. But you also have the men's basketball team facing off against Laurentian at the Athletic Complex Gym at 8 p.m. This Saturday, you got the swim team versus Golden Hawks tri-meet. So I guess it's Golden Hawk versus Golden Hawk at the Athletic Complex in Waterloo. And if you didn't know, we do have a swim team. And we do have a giant Olympic-sized pool at the gym. I believe it's open to all students. You just got to register or sign up your name or something like that. Just look it up. There's a website for it. But more importantly, you got the 117th Yates Cup. That's right. The football team faces off against Queens in a battle on who gets the Yates Cup at the Knight Newborough Field at University Stadium at 1 p.m. That is at the stadium right across from Waterloo College Hall. Our football team is legendary. And I'm very confident that we'll bring it home. We'll bring yet another Yates Cup home. On Saturday, you also have the women's basketball team facing off against Nipissing at the Athletic Complex Gym at 6 p.m. and the men's basketball team facing off against Nipissing at the Athletic Complex Gym at 8 p.m. And on Wednesday, the 12th of November, once again, you guessed it, the basketball team. You got the women's basketball team facing off against Guelph at the Athletic Complex Gym at 6 p.m. and the men's basketball team facing off against Guelph yet again at the Athletic Complex Gym at 8 p.m. Get your tickets for all those and more at laurier.universitytickets.com. Once again, that is laurier.universitytickets.com. I got some hot off the press Laurier news for you on the Campus Life Waterloo Instagram page. Did you know that there are 50 tickets for the Yates Cup that are 50% off? It's for students only, 2 tickets per student, and these can be purchased at the student union desk at the second floor of the FNCC. Let me clarify something here. These are not, you don't buy 50 tickets for 50% off. They have 50 tickets for 50% off. Students can only buy 2 tickets per student. So if you want to go see the Yates Cup, head on over to the second floor of the FNCC, the Fred Nicholas Campus Center, at the student union desk. For its first come and first serve. And we also have glow-in-the-dark roller rink. It's your time to shine. You can join them for an unforgettable glow-in-the-dark roller rink night from A-Team and Healthy Lifestyles. Make sure to grab your friends, throw on your brightest neon, and roll into the night with music, lights, and tasty snacks. You can come see Laurier Glow on Thursday, November 13th, a week from today, from 6 to 10 p.m. at the turret, which is the third floor of the Fred Nicholas Campus Center. And finally, for the news segment, you can come and support the team at Radio Laurier. Yes. Radio Laurier is having a cookie sale. Partnering up with Sweet Lou's Cookies on November 13th, head over to the concourse from 12 to 4 p.m. to get some cookies. It is $4 for one cookie and $7 for 2 cookies. And there's one more news thing I meant to add. If you know someone that is interested, Radio Laurier is gauging interest for jam sessions. If you want to jam with other Laurier musicians, make sure to DM the Radio Laurier Instagram account. You didn't hear this from me, but I hear they're trying to set up some pretty cool Battle of the Bands ideas. So if you're interested, if you play music, or you know someone that plays music, or if you're in a band, definitely head over and DM Radio Laurier's Instagram account, because they are looking for some musical players. Seems we're going to end the show a little early. I thought I had more content prepared, but I guess not. That was episode 6 of season 2, and you know what? We're going to do a double. We're going to do a double feature of music for you. How about that? There's your treat. I'll do a double feature of music for you. That was episode 6 of season 2 of Weather Aware with Liam, presented by the Morning Show, Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to tune in next week for your weekly forecast and more. Make sure to follow the official Weather Aware Instagram page at Weather Aware Liam, and please look out on Saturday for that update video on the snowstorm, because in my past experience, trust me, a lot can change in 2 days. So please, please, please be on the lookout for that so that you can stay safe and stay weather aware with the storm. Hope you have a great day, Golden Hawks. And remember, stay weather aware. As much as I'm usually a fan of snow, I gotta say, it being this early is a very big oddity, but it's only one of a variety of weather oddities lately, so I'm gonna play us off with a different kind of oddity. Space Oddity by David Bowie on Radio Laurier. That was Space Oddity by David Bowie. Next up, a David Bowie double feature, Sound and Vision, specifically the 2013 version by David Bowie on Radio Laurier. That was Sound and Vision by David Bowie. Next up, I think it's only right we do a triple David Bowie feature. Yeah, I know. And I think I'm going to play us off the last song, the song that I have only recently heard about. It was on the way up back to Waterloo. We had to sit in 3 hours of traffic. And this song came on. So without further ado, I'm going to play us off with Modern Love by David Bowie on Radio Laurier.